Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Skylar Jeremias. Patent thickets, patent litigation, patent dances, all of these legal terms have plagued the biosimilar space, causing many biosimilar products to launch well after the originator's market exclusivity was supposed to expire. A perfect example of this is the Stelara or ustekinumab space, where patent litigation settlements have led to delayed market access for ustekinumab biosimilars from late 2023 to early 2025. Additionally, congressional leaders have had to investigate AbbVie for potentially abusing the patent system to stall biosimilar competition for Humira, also known as adalimumab. But why does the system work like this? What can be done to improve it? What actions can be taken to ensure the patent system doesn't hinder competition and innovation? Today, I'm joined by Hakun Wong, an IP attorney and partner at Venable LLP, as well as a member of the Center for Biosimilars Advisory Board, to discuss the current landscape of the biosimilar legal sector and how the U.S. patent system can be improved to ensure market sustainability. Thanks for joining us, Hakun. To start us off, do you foresee any potential shifts or reforms in patent law that could positively or negatively impact the biosimilar sector in the near future?
So predicting whether there will be statutory shifts or reform in patent law is like trying to predict what will happen in the next Fast and the Furious movie. You have no idea what's specifically going to happen, but it's probably going to have some explosions that ultimately will not be applicable to the real world. That being said, there are a few things, I think, that we might want to keep an eye on. And I say very few only because we've seen a lot of things introduced and not a lot of follow through. You know, there's a lot of good intentions out there, but there's not a lot of follow through. But that being said, here it is. There's a couple things that I think we should keep an eye on. First of all, Senators Welch, Braun, and Klobuchar introduced legislation in the Senate and Representative Arrington in the House on January 2024 that would limit the number of patents that could be asserted in a patent litigation. And if this were to proceed, this may or may not have a practical effect, because we've seen that most BPCIA lawsuits that have been asserted are asserted on 10 or less patents. So having a limit, artificial limit, may not make it any better, but it might. Who knows? Certainly something to keep an eye on. The Biosimilar Red Tape Elimination Act was introduced in July of 2023 by Senators Lee, Lujan, Braun, and Vance, and that bill would eliminate the two separate designations of biosimilars and interchangeables, which we know exists in the U.S., and we're the only country that does that. Every other country in the world only has one level of biosimilarity. So it's possible if the interchangeability requirement was removed, there could be greater uptake of biosimilars due to the possibility of automatic substitution at the pharmacy level, like we see with generic drugs. And there may be increased confidence in biosimilars because they would be seen as perhaps closer to the reference product. You know, the problem is that when people hear there's a biosimilar, but there's a higher level called interchangeable, their automatic reaction is, well, that means biosimilars are garbage. Why would I want that? I want an interchangeable. Oh, there's no interchangeable. I don't want that product. So I think that it will help with consumer confidence, patient confidence, and will help with healthcare provider confidence, because a lot of doctors just don't know the difference. Also, in June of 2023, Senators Tillis and Kuhn reintroduced the Patent Eligibility and Restoration Act of 2023 to reform patentability requirements under Section 101. There, the bill seeks to clarify which inventions are eligible for patenting in the U.S. If that bill were to be passed, it would overturn Supreme Court decisions in Mayo, Alice, and Myriad, which we have all been talking about for like 10 years. So it would be really interesting to see how that would impact the pharmaceutical and biologics industry in particular. And finally, there's been this increased congressional scrutiny of pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. Now, Congress has launched various investigations into PBM practices, and while this isn't directly related to patent law reform, it could have a significant impact on biosimilar uptake, given the preferential formulary coverage of biosimilars and how that plays a big role in whether biosimilars are used and whether cost savings are realized or not. And I've been on record of saying this for a long time now. PBMs are middlemen that don't need to really be there, I don't think. But at the end of the day, they end up increasing the cost for patients. And it'd be interesting to see if all this congressional scrutiny will lead to better cost savings for patients.
How does the patent system impact biosimilar accessibility, and how can it be improved to better balance investor interests and the need for more affordable healthcare options?
By and large, the patent system is really no different with respect to biosimilar accessibility as it is to small molecule accessibility or any other area of life sciences. As outlined in the Constitution, good patents help protect innovation, which in turn provides incentive for development of new life-saving treatments, as well as disclosure of information to promote continued development of those treatments. The problem that we have is that not all patents are good, right? There are bad patents. The FDA and the USPTO have been collaborating to provide a more robust patent system for pharmaceutical patents, and more robust in terms of making sure good patents come out and not bad patents. For instance, they've proposed more training and time for patent examiners during prosecution. Better examination means better patents. And they've encouraged increased disclosure of regulatory materials during prosecution. So this proposal could help to avoid patents being issued that should not be, either based on not properly meeting the patentability requirements or by inappropriately overlapping with earlier issued patents, which could in turn lower the number of bad patents that biosimilars would have to contend with. That being said, the patent system as is hasn't necessarily negatively impacted biosimilar accessibility. Biosimilars are getting to the market and are bringing prices down and providing more affordable healthcare, even when they don't necessarily capture large market shares. According to the quarter four 2023 report by Samsung Bioepis, the average sales price declined on an average of 41% 3 years post biosimilar launch and over 50% in the oncology space. So there is a lot of benefit here from biosimilar launches, and patents aren't necessarily stopping that from happening. But we should be vigilant about bad patents. We don't want those to be allowed.
Now we're starting to see some of the settlements for patent cases involving ustekinumab biosimilars, as well as new cases regarding aflibercept biosimilars. What other biosimilar court cases should stakeholders be watching?
Well, there are a number of them, and keep in mind that a lot of these biosimilars cases are fact-specific, so they don't necessarily will not necessarily will result in something that will have wide-ranging impact on the industry. But I do think there are a couple that we should keep an eye on. First of all, Eylea has five pending lawsuits, a number of pending IPRs, and at least five pending ABLAs. So this is definitely going to be a drug to watch in terms of decisions and market impact. Soliris, they had a first litigation related to the proposed Soliris biosimilar. SB12 was just filed on January 3rd of this year by Alexion against Samsung Bioepis. Samsung Bioepis provided its 180-day notice of commercial marketing over 6 months ago in July of 2023, which means it could launch at risk at any point after receiving FDA approval. It was a pending ABLA that was accepted by the FDA by July of 2023. So it's possible that launch could be as soon if Alexion doesn't request a preliminary injunction. So there's a lot of things here, a lot of moving parts here that we want to keep an eye on to see how that impacts the process in which a biosimilar might go through if they want to be aggressive and launch at risk. There's Tysabri, which has an ongoing litigation related to to that product. It's a Sandoz product, Tysabri. And there's a biosimilar, Tyruko, which was FDA approved in August. The preliminary injunction was denied in June. Sandoz has expressed a plan to launch at risk in the first half of 2024. This would be the first biosimilar launch for Tysabri, which was approved almost 20 years ago. So certainly something to keep an eye on there as well.
Recently, CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield filed a lawsuit against Johnson & Johnson alleging that the company is scheming to delay ustekinumab biosimilar competition. How do you expect this case to play out, and what impact could it have on the overall biosimilar industry?
Okay, so this is not the first antitrust suit to be filed related to a biosimilar and biosimilar competition, particularly on drugs that are costly. So it really isn't surprising to see another antitrust suit. And as a side note, talking about antitrust always reminds me of the 2001 movie Antitrust, starring Ryan Phillippe and Rachel Leigh Cook. I digress. So previous antitrust suits, that I think that we want to think about in conjunction with this one would be the Remicade exclusionary contracting class action lawsuit. That actually was settled by consumers third party payers for $25 million. There was the Remicade exclusionary contracting lawsuit by Inflectra biosimilar manufacturer Pfizer. There was an undisclosed settlement agreement there. And then the Humira lawsuit, which found that filing numerous patent applications was a form of petitioning the government and qualified for Norr-Pennington immunity. And that protects the filing under the First Amendment petition and free speech clause. So even if the petitioning is anti-competitive, it's immune from antitrust action. So I bring those up because so far the biosimilar antitrust suits may have had some positive impact on decreasing the usage of exclusionary contracts to prevent biosimilar formulary coverage. However, it's yet to be seen, maybe debatable, how steep of a deterrent something like a $25 million settlement is on a drug similar to Remicade, which is making over $6 billion a year. So it's unclear whether another lawsuit will have, or another antitrust lawsuit will have, a significant impact on biosimilars going forward or not. But certainly something that we should keep an eye on, and certainly something that we should be vigilant about.
What are the key objectives to the patent dance, and how does it contribute to streamlining the exchange of information while reducing the potential for wasteful litigation?
The patent dance allows for an early assessment of infringement and validity positions, even before the filing of a litigation. And that can help parties reach an early settlement. And that's kind of part of the process here. Is don't slow down biosimilar approval process. Don't subject them to damages from launching at risk. Let's resolve all the patent issues in advance, or at the time in which you're looking to get approval, such so that you can get it resolved at the time you get approval. If you don't have a problem with the patent, then you can launch without any risk and you're okay. If you do, then let's sort that out. And I think that's really exactly what the Hatch-Waxman does for the small molecules. And that's what this BPCIA patent dance does for biosimilars. And it's been really effective. I think generally, as we said before, it's led to a great number of settlements. Very few of them go to trial, which means we're not wasting resources on litigation. And as much as I do litigation, so I like to have litigation, I think for my clients, it's a win-win all the way around. And also, the case management mechanisms have also been very effective at limiting the size of the litigations. So, for example, in the recently decided Regeneron v. Mylan case relating to Eylea, despite 24 patents initially being asserted, the case was initially narrowed to six patents and then further narrowed to three patents for an expedited trial that provided the companies with resolution. One patent was found valid and infringed, without having to litigate all the asserted patents. So I think, by and large, it's working to really save resources for all parties involved. And if it has to go to litigation, it goes. But by and large, it also is resulting in favorable settlements in which everybody wins.
What actions do government authorities need to take to ensure fair competition in the biosimilar market?
Yeah, no, but so interestingly, when you say government authorities, it always reminds me again of one of my favorite franchises, The Fast and the Furious, because in the later movies, essentially 6 through 10, they sometimes work with a mysterious government agency called the agency, creatively. So I'm visualizing Vin Diesel parachuting into a biologics company office in his 1970 Dodge Charger to ensure his family, or what he likes to call his mi familia, and the biosimilar market are treated fairly. I know that's not actually happening, but I really, really wish it would. I'm not sure if the government should do much more than what they already do. They monitor for antitrust violations and ensure that critical medications have special status to ensure they get to patients quickly, like we saw during the pandemic. But there are a few things Congress and the FDA might consider to make things move a little quicker and ensure more robust biosimilar competition. For instance, they could eliminate the separate categories of biosimilar and interchangeable to eliminate confusion for patients and prescribers and to allow for automatic substitution at the pharmacy level. As I mentioned previously, we know in Europe that it works. They've been doing that for many, many years. They've had one level of biosimilar, and that biosimilar is interchangeable at the pharmacy level. So perhaps we use that experience base that we see in Europe and do something similar in the United States. It might also provide better awareness and better avenues for biosimilars to be listed higher up in insurance formularies, such that patients will have access to better coverage for biosimilars as well.
What do you wish more people understood about how patent litigation impacts biosimilars?
So there's a couple things, first of all. Although we don't want bad patents, as I talked about earlier, it's not really bad patents that are impacting biosimilar access. Patents actually have been found valid a number of times. So as long as they're good patents, we shouldn't shortcut the good patents. Now, of the litigations that have gone to verdict, all the patents but two have been found valid. And in IPRs, few patents for biologic have been found invalid. Out of the biologics with patents challenged at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, of 14 biologics with completed IPRs, six have not lost any patents, and four have lost only one or two patents. The most patents that have been lost so far is seven for a single biologic. So there, they did their job. They got rid of the bad patents. So long as good patents are being enforced, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It helps promote innovation, as we talked about earlier. What we have to be wary of are those bad patents, which are those that are incremental in nature and not significantly improving over older technologies and really just meant to be a roadblock. And I think those are being handled well in the judicial system so far. So when people say patents are bad, let's not go overboard, okay? Yes, there can be bad patents, but just like everything, there can be good ones too. Also, it's important to understand that drug monopolies are maybe not as long as people think they are. If you consider that generally a patent should be given a 20-year time frame, many of the drugs of biosimilar competition have had less than 20 years on the market without competition. So that in many ways demonstrates that there are avenues for biosimilars to get on the market and be competitive and also allow lower cost alternatives that are in advance of that patent frame. You know, so it's, I think that people tend to think that, oh my gosh, 20 years is so long. It's not usually that long. Now, part of that, again, is the effect of patent life, which we talked about previously, which is only 12 years. And a lot of that is because, of course, the patent system, the way it's set up, they tend to file those drug composition patents early and then method of use and formulation much, much later on in the process. So that's definitely something that people should know, that the patent system isn't all particularly bad here. This is the patent system is not necessarily meant to keep competition off. It's meant to be a legal monopoly in some ways, but it's meant to provide time for the innovator to recoup the benefits of developing the product. And then at some point in time, allow the competition and lower access and increase access at lower prices. I think that's something that people should to take a good look at, because the end result is that everyone benefits from that. Everyone keeps building on it. They keep getting new innovations, new products, and then we eventually will get that access and improved cost for products. And it's typically earlier than the patents expire. So it's not something where patents are really keeping people off. Some examples of that are Remicade. They had 18 years. Solaris had 18. Neulasta, 16. And Lucentis, 16. Avastin and Stelara at 15. So yeah, it's not 10 years, but it's not 20. It's kind of in between. I think the last thing is that people see patent litigation as what's holding up biosimilar uptake. And while it does have some impact, there's also the issue with usage of biosimilars that are on the market. Patients are not seeing the significant cost savings for a lot of biosimilars because costs are being kept high, part of which could be related to PBMs, part of it is related to insurance coverage. And I think that because of that, it gets a little bit of low uptake because of lack of insurance coverage. So I think that insurance is in part in fault here as well. For example, Humira biosimilars, which had long been seen as the biggest potential for cost savings, have only seen a 2% market share in this last year on the market. I mean, only 2% on something that people thought, oh, if we get this biosimilar in the market, we're going to save so much money. Why is it that only 2% market share? And Humira really hasn't dropped its prices in order to keep the market share as well. In fact, it shows that Humira's price is about, you know, is about the same, although it's $130 less than WAC. So I guess that's maybe some cost savings. I think it's important to realize that there's a number of different factors that impact access. And one of the biggest factors that impact access is insurance coverage. Unfortunately, insurance agencies don't want to cover things that are expensive, and that makes sense. But the problem is that biosimilars also haven't been lowering their prices significantly, and so therefore they're not being covered because the innovator would then provide rebates in order to get their prices lower. And that's a weird thing, right? Because we want to get biosimilars on the market, but if they're not actually cheaper, then what's the point? I don't actually know what the point is. And I think we got to talk about just better education for healthcare providers and patients because they just don't understand the usefulness and safety of biosimilars. So they're just not getting prescribed at the level they should be. So hopefully better education to healthcare providers and patients, telling them this is safe and effective. Biosimilars are things you can take. It's not a different drug. That will help with uptake as well.
Well, Hakun, thank you for sharing your insights with us. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of Not So Different. You can find additional information on everything we discussed in the show notes. And until next time, you can visit us at centerforbiosimilars.com.